In accordance with state law regarding public meetings held via electronic equipment, this meeting will be recorded and the recording will be posted on the authority's website. We need to start with a roll call of board members. My name is Peter Lisi, obviously present. Mike Angelini.
Present.
Thank you. Lawrence Davis. No. Steve Elbaum.
Present.
Thank you. Kimberly Kennison.
Present.
Thank you. Susan Martin.
Present.
Thank you. Kimberly Moores.
Present.
Thank you. Sess Thompson. Sess? No. Mark Vahalik.
I am here.
Thank you. All right. Individuals are asked to state their name and title before speaking during the meeting. Votes will be taken by roll call unless the vote is unanimous. In the event the meeting is interrupted due to technical difficulties, members and staff will receive a text or an email advising whether number one, the meeting is adjourned or canceled, or number two, the time the meeting will resume. So, with the preamble done, I'd like to welcome everyone. Thank you for making yourself available. And I'll call the meeting to order. First item of business is a review and hopefully approval of the minutes from our October 15th meeting. Is there a motion to adopt the minutes as presented?
So moved.
Thank you, Steve. Is there a second?
I'll second. It's Mike.
Thank you, Mike. All right, it's been moved and seconded to adopt the minutes as presented. Are there any edits or corrections that need to be made? Any discussion on the minutes? Anything at all? All right, hearing none, motion's been made and seconded. All those in favor of adopting the minutes as presented, please say aye.
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 Is there anyone opposed? Any abstentions?
Peter, it's Sue Martin. I'll abstain. I was not present for that meeting.
Thank you, Susan. One abstention. Motion carries. Thank you. All right, next item is our annual ethics training. I will turn the floor over to Peter Lewandowski from the Office of State Ethics. Peter, the microphone and camera is yours.
Thank you. Good afternoon, everyone. Again, for the record, my name is Peter Lewandowski. I'm the Executive Director of the Office of State Ethics, and this will be an abridged ethics presentation for the staff and the board of CHIPA. I will just bear with me one second. I will try to share my screen here with you for some. Okay. I'm not sure if you could confirm for me whether you can see this presentation on the screen.
Not yet.
Not yet. Okay. We'll try again. I'm sorry. Okay. Right. Try to open, just bear with me. And if what's going on here, but
Do you, this is Kara. Do you
here
have
we
multiple
go.
screens?
I think, can you see it now?
Yes.
Okay, thank you. I apologize for this. So I'll start again. This should take about 20 minutes. I'll go through the presentation, and any questions you may have, feel free to ask at the end, or I understand you are under time constraints. You can send me an email or give me a call later on. So again, this is your annual training. Just a reminder, you as public officials, also state employees, and in addition, lobbyists and state contractors are subject to the Code of Ethics here in Connecticut, Code of Ethics for public officials in this case. The main provisions of the code are use of state positions, gifts, conflicts, private employment, contracting and revolving door provisions, and we'll focus on these six. Just provide you with a basic overview. The most important point that I can impart is always get advice. Sarah Clark, who's our director of education, annually states we are the other call before you dig agency. And again, I think it's important to stress that we are your resource. So any questions you have, please direct them to us. Denise Aguilera is your ethics liaison. And so any questions you may have relative to the ethics code, feel free to go through Denise or come directly to us. Your agency has an ethics statement and policies published. It's an extensive document, and any questions relative to your internal policies should be directed to Denise and your legal counsel. So let's start with the basic provisions. The most important or the overarching provision of the code is prohibition on use of state position or authority for personal financial gain or that of your immediate family members. And here we're talking about your spouse, your children, children's spouses, parents, and siblings. Also financial gain of any associated businesses. And we're talking about businesses that are for-profit businesses or non-for-profit entities from which you derive some financial gain. If you are simply volunteering for a nonprofit or some community organization, let's say you're a board member of a local nonprofit from which you do not derive any financial gain, that entity is not considered an associated business. And technically under the code, you may take official action for the benefit of that entity because again, it's not considered an associated business under the Code of Ethics. So quickly, a couple of scenarios illustrating a use of state position. Let's say you're picking up your meeting report, and this is more for staff members at the office printer. You find a stack of envelopes with coworker's home address, pre-printed with a return address space. Is this an acceptable use of state office supplies or resources? Well, it is not. I mean, clearly, this is kind of a teachable moment. Part of the prohibition is not to use state resources equipment for personal purpose, especially personal purpose that would from which you would derive some financial gain. Another example, a manager at Chefa has an enterprising teenager who is beginning to her own babysitting business. Is it appropriate for this manager to encourage staff to employ their daughter for childcare services? Clearly, that would be a prohibited activity. It would be an impermissible use of authority, as obviously subordinates would be compelled to clearly or feel under pressure to utilize the services of the manager's daughter for childcare. So again, in this case, it would be prohibited. Another topic of gifts. Gifts are defined as anything of value directly or personally received, unless consideration of equal or greater value is given in return. So there has to be some kind of a market exchange for an item not to be considered a gift. So keep that in mind. Clearly, there is a prohibition on acceptance of gifts from registered lobbyists, from anyone who's doing or seeking to do business with your agency, and also a prohibition on accepting gifts from pre-qualified vendors or contractors that are posted on the Department of Administrative Services pre-qualified vendor list. Unless, of course, those gifts are provided under applicable gift exceptions, and there are a number of exceptions under the code. I'll focus briefly on a couple of them. But again, keep in mind the type of donors you may be encountering. We've already described restricted donors. There may be also non-restricted donors who are giving you a gift by virtue of your state position. Let's say you're invited to speak as a board member of your agency at some function, and the sponsoring entity provides you with something or with certain benefits. So again, because you're being invited by virtue of your state position, there's a $100 limit. Plus, you may utilize also all the applicable exceptions available to restricted donors. Finally, if you're receiving a gift that's not from a non-restricted entity that's not given to you by virtue of your state position, there's no limitation. Common gift exceptions, again, token items, anything under $10, food and beverage under $50, provided the sponsor or the person who's providing food and beverage to you is present. Obviously, in this day and age, food and beverage costs can exceed $50 quite easily. You can always pay down the difference down to $50 to be compliant under this gift exception. Rebates and discounts that are generally provided to state employees or public officials, discounts by major corporate entities out there, you know, let's say government discount at a hotel. That's fine, so long as these discounts do not target specific agency. And finally, ceremonial plaques for in recognition of your service, they have to be under $100 in value. Clearly, if you have restricted donors in your family and they're listed here, there's no restriction on acceptance of gifts from family members that happen to be restricted donors. Among coworkers, there is a $99.99 limit per gift. Pooling between subordinates and supervisors. So we always recommend supervisors should give a separate gift. There is a $1,000 gift exception for major life events, and those major life events are listed here. In terms of attending conferences, generally, if you're you're attending in your official capacity, depending whether you're active participant, you know, a speaker, panelist, or a moderator of a panel, or let's say a passive participant, you may receive from private entities travel costs, lodging, meals, and related conference expenses, so long as these are not lavish. And the standard for lavishness is, what would the state pay to send you to a conference? Clearly, first class travel, penthouse lodging would not be acceptable for the state to cover. Also, no fees or honoraria or entertainment. That's out of your own pocket. And finally, there is a reporting requirement if you're traveling out of state or receiving lodging and the entity is a non-governmental entity that's paying for those benefits. You have to report those benefits within 30 days to the Office of State Ethics. There's a simple form to do that. Gifts to the state, agencies may accept equipment, services for use on state or quasi-public agency property that support participation of a public official or state employee at an event. Let's say there's a conference, again, and you're attending to learn something about the industry within which you operate. And the sponsor wishes to sponsor that conference and cover the expenses for your staff or the board to attend, that would be permissible gift to the state. And again, so long as these type of events facilitate state action or your agency, quasi-public agency's action or functions. What happens if inadvertently you receive a prohibited gift? You realize after the fact, oh, this gift does not meet any exceptions. No need to panic. You have a 30-day window to make it right. You can always, obviously, you can always refuse the gift. But in case you've accepted it already, you can always return it to the donor or recommend to the donor to return it to give it to a charity, provided you do not derive any tax benefit from that donation. And finally, you may also pay the fair market value for the gift if you receive it. Again, everything has to take place within that 30-day window. Scenario quickly involving gifts. Your longtime friend gets hired by a government relations department of a Fortune 500 company. The company is a registered lobbyist. You're going out to dinner and he wants to pay for this dinner. Can your friend pay for your dinner? Well, if your friend is getting reimbursed by the company, clearly strict limitations of $50 must apply. Also, if your friend happens to be a registered communicator lobbyist because he works for the government relations department, not all folks who work in those type of departments are registered to lobby. But if he is, then again, strict limits apply. Otherwise, no limitations would be triggered. Conflicts of interest. This is important, obviously, for both the board and staff. Under Connecticut law, we usually deal with direct and potential conflicts. And there's fewer, I'll say a few words about appearance of a conflict. Generally, under substantial conflicts, direct conflicts exist if you have a reason to believe or expect that you, your spouse, dependent child, or associated business will obtain direct monetary gain or suffer direct monetary loss by reason of your official activity in a way that is distinctly different. This is the key, distinctly different from others in the same profession or group. And with substantial conflicts, you have to recuse yourself. In the case of staff, prepare a written statement to a supervisor. And in the case of board members, written statement or a statement on the record of the proceeding that you have a conflict, substantial conflict. Under potential conflicts, those occur when you have when official action that would affect financial interest of slightly bigger group here, your spouse, parents, brothers, siblings, and children and their spouses, and also associated businesses. You have a reasonable expectation that there is a potential conflict, and again, the interest is distinct from a substantial segment of the public. In this case, there is a distinct treatment for staff and board members when we deal with potential conflicts. Staff have to recuse themselves and inform their supervisors. Board members, they have two options. You can always recuse yourself on the record or make a statement on the record that despite this potential conflict, you may still act in public's interest. So you have two options, couple options as a board member when dealing with potential conflicts. Your spouse is a developer. This is a scenario involving conflict and wants to obtain a grant from GFA. Can you utilize your connections to cut through the red tape to get the application through the process expeditiously? Clearly, that would be a conflict. So the answer is no. Appearances are left really to judgment and discretion. The code is silent as to appearances of a conflict. Now, you're more. Your internal policy or ethics statement may address appearances, and some agencies do. But when we talk about the general code of ethics, really, if we're talking about exclusively about appearances, then it's left to your judgment and discretion whether to act. Outside employment, just briefly, generally, your outside employment must not impair your independence of judgment as to your state duties. No disclosure of confidential information that you learn in state service for the benefit of your outside employer, and you may not use your state position for the benefit of your outside employment. In your private employment, you provide financial investment consultancy to private clients. You're planning to launch a new interactive website and increase your social media presence to promote your services. In promoting your services online, can you include the fact that you are connected to Chifa? The answer is, excuse me, and strictly biographical information. If you have a resume or LinkedIn page, that's okay. If, however, you weave the fact that you are connected to the quasi-public in your promotional narratives, promotional literature to potential clients, that's a problem and that's prohibited. So. Biographical statements on your resume or LinkedIn page are fine. Promotional narratives or promotional literature, that's a no. And state contracting, just one note for this is applicable only to board members and the head of the agency, quasi-public agency board, if you as a board member exercise control over a contract subject matter, the board member may not contract with the quasi-public agency unless the contract is process is open and public. So for example, you have an associated business wishes to contract with you, a quasi-public agency, that contract has to undergo open and public process. So no sole source contracts are allowed. Executive head of the agency may not contract with their own agency. Revolving door, we have two lifetime bans and 1 year bans. Lifetime, no disclosure of confidential information, and also ban on representation concerning particular matters in which you as a public official participated substantially. In other words, it's a site switching prohibition on awarding specific contracts or grants. 1 year bans are, you're prohibited for 1 year from representing anyone for compensation before this agency once you leave CHIFA, and you may not pursue employment with the recipient of a contract in excess of $50,000 if that contract was awarded in the final year of your state service and you were instrumentally involved in awarding or proposing or negotiating that contract. Quickly, a scenario involving post-state employment. Upon leaving state service, can you join a lobbying firm that engages in both legislative and executive branch lobbying? Can you represent clients before the legislative committees immediately upon leaving state service? The short answer is yes. Again, we're only talking about cooling off representation before your own agency. You may represent clients before before the legislature. Immediately upon leaving state service. Two words, I'm almost done. A couple words about enforcement. Again, our enforcement is initiated by a complaint. It can be filed by a member of the public or initiated by our office. And any complaint while it's ongoing remains confidential. And confidentiality is critical in our process. Ethics matters can be detrimental to someone's professional and personal reputation. That's why confidentiality is so critical until a judicial authority, a judge of the Superior Court, determines that there is sufficient, evidence to proceed to an open hearing. And once it's determined that the violation did indeed occur, our board can impose certain penalties, require you to comply with the code. In the future, file any outstanding statements or reports and impose penalties up to $10,000 per violation. You can also provide us with anonymous tips. You can have communications with our agency or through your ethics liaison and regarding any questionable issues that you encounter. So we are available to you. And finally, keep in mind that executive branch agencies, as well as quasi-publics, have so-called mandatory reporters, and that's the agency head, deputy, persons in charge of procurement, contracting, and human resources. They have to report any alleged violations if they have a reasonable cause to believe that a person has violated the ethics code. That's all I have. I will stop sharing and answer any questions you may have. If not, as I said at the beginning, feel free to give me a call, shoot me an email, or call our office with any questions.
Thank you, Peter. Are there any questions for Peter? Anything at all? Okay, Peter, I appreciate the abridged version. Asking to move through quickly, though, it certainly doesn't imply that we take the ethics code lightly, but we do appreciate it very much. Thank you. And if there are no questions, we can move on. All right. Thank you, Peter.
All right. Thank you for having me.
Yep. Okay. Next item on the agenda, we have several updates and reports. Jeanette, would you like to start with the authority update?
Sure. Thanks, Peter. So I just want to let the board know today and tomorrow there's a special session going on in the legislature. One of the things that is being brought up is authorizing a bond package to fund UConn Health Center's acquisition of Waterbury Hospital and also potentially Bristol Hospital and Day Kimball Hospital. So many of the detail, you know, nothing has been fully finalized. There's a lot of details to be worked out. But as we've reported at different points, Bristol Hospital has been struggling. And so I think, you know, our expectation is if this happens, our bonds would be paid off. So from that perspective, I think, you know, that would probably be a positive. And then, you know, we did have some discussions with the treasurer's office and also with the governor's office about, you know, was any of this suitable for a chief of financing? But I think it makes sense, the approach they're using, it's going to be issued by UConn under their UConn 2000 authority, which means it's issued under the name of UConn, but it's the debt service is paid by the state. And given the circumstances and financials, I think that makes sense. So that's all I have as a general authority. Okay.
Thank you, Jeanette. Any questions? Okay, thank you. Moving on, Dan, client updates.
Yeah, I'm gonna start with market updates first. In your supplemental materials that you received yesterday, there was a brief market update. Over the past week, Treasury yields have been mixed, while the municipal yields have seen a little change. Over the past year, we've kind of seen a steepening of the yield curve with longer-term MMD and Treasuries increasing, while short-term yields are falling. For the year, we've topped $500 billion in new issuance. This is the second year in a row of a record amount. The volume still expected to be around $10 billion this week for the holiday shortened week, with still strong demand for these issuances. With the government shutdown coming to an end, hopefully that comes with it the release of economic data for the past couple of weeks. Economic data has been postponed. And there's hopes that this would start allowing some of the September data to come out by the mid-November. And then finally, the Fed funds target rate right now is 3.75 to 4%. And the market is implying a probability of a 25 basis cut of 65% for the December meeting and 40% chance for the December 28th meeting. Looking kind of at your interest rates, obviously, held steady over the past week, and the SOFR rate for our direct placements has been steady as well. Any questions?
Dan, did you say that the market is priced in two rate cuts before the end of the calendar year?
Way they phrased it is priced in one price cut in is already priced in, but the probability is the implied probability is a 25 basis cut of 65%. For December, yeah, and a 40% probability for January.
Okay, thank you.
All right. Moving on to client updates. In your board package was the financing forecast. Kind of want to highlight a significant transaction, energy as a service transaction. This is a Hartford Healthcare transaction that's coming to date that we just kicked off. The schedule for this transaction would be closed by early March, and that is the timeline meetings. It's going to be most likely a January and February board presentation and approval. With that, due to the complexities of this transaction, which requires many different moving parts and different agreements, staff is organizing board education regarding this types of financing, and that will be presented at the special board meeting in December 10th. Another transaction that's coming up is kicking off is the Yale remarketing of the 2014 A's and the 2017 C2 bond issuances, and that will happen early next year. We've recently done some outreach to some of our existing clients. We've had conversations with Taft School. They're exploring possibility of a new transaction coming next year for new residence halls, as they possibly contemplate transforming, kind of moving away some of the day school enrollment to boarding enrollment. And so this would require the investments in residence halls. We also had visits with Trinity College and Fairfield Country Day School as it relates to our board presentations. And then finally, kudos to Dan G and Jen for organizing a great event at Stanford Boys and Girls Club. We were down there for to celebrate the Enterprise Capital Grant Award. The event was attended, obviously, also with the mayor from Caroline Simmons. You should have all received an email yesterday from Dan G. He was able to produce some videos that kind of highlighted the event as well. So. And then, like I said, just a reminder, we have a special board meeting scheduled for December 10th at 1 p.m., and that will be virtual.
Okay. Any questions for Dan? Okay, Dan, I just have a quick one. Going back to your comments on Taft School for new residence hall, are those replaced? Is that a replacement or additive?
It's the school's still in the kind of exploring kind of what their demand is.
Yeah.
I think
But
what they're
you said that they're going to be moving away from the mix right now that they currently have between boarders and day students. They want to have more boarders, is that correct?
yeah, they look at it at the volatility on the day school enrollment. They prefer rather to put those more as the boarding ones, which are more reliable enrollment levels. So they're not getting rid of the day schools, but they're just kind of projecting to lower that.
Do they have a fairly large contingent of international students that are boarders?
I can't remember from the sentence in my notes.
That's all right. It's not that important. I just wondered
Yeah,
if
so
they were
we asked about
dependent
their
on.
exposure, kind of obviously. So that was like obviously a concern. What is their international? And obviously, most of those are expected to be full payers.
Yeah.
Coincidentally, actually, they commented most of their international students are on financial aid. So
Interesting.
it wouldn't be a significant impact, obviously, if those students did not return.
It's interesting. Okay, thank you. Any other questions for Dan? Okay, Charles, financial report.
Yep, thanks. Charles Boddy, Managing Director of Finance and Operations at Chifa. Today we're going to take a look at the results for the quarter ended September 30th, 2025, which is the first fiscal quarter of our year 2026. Kara, if I could ask you to go to page 32. So here is our typical income statement that we provide when we do our quarterly reviews. I am going to start at the bottom with the line labeled change in net position, which is our excess of revenues over expenses. You see $475,574 at quarter end, which compares favorably to our budget number in the next column, 408,752. That's a favorability of $66,822. That favorability is primarily driven off of the salary and benefits lines that you see in the middle of the page, where you see a negative 49,692 and right below that a negative 17,000. Those two numbers together is approximately 67,000, so it drives the entire nearly the entirety of our favorability. Salaries are below budget due to a vacancy in a position for the full quarter, as well as some employees that were on leave during the quarter with their salary paid out of short-term disability. So that's driving the primary favorability that we see in the quarter. There is some unfavorability up on the administrative fees revenue, the top line, as our primary source of revenue. That is driven by a decline in the outstanding bond issue balances due to some prepayments of principal that occurred in the first quarter. Offsetting that, you can't see the number on the page, but there's approximately 20,000 favorability in expense items that are not related to salaries and benefits. If you look to the prior year, where our net income for the first quarter was $1,249,000 in the far right column, it's a little bit of apples and oranges when you're looking year over year, as last year did not include a large outflow of grant dollars on the program related expense line, and last year did have higher investment income. But if you just look purely at operations, you'll see that the operating revenues for the first quarter 25 at $2,107,000 is higher than the actual operating revenues last year, and the operating expenses in this quarter are lower than they were last year. So favorable not just to budget this year, but quarterly year over year. Any questions on the Q1 income statement?
No.
Okay, Kara, if you could take me to page 30. This is the asset page of the balance sheet. So right in the middle of the page, you'll see institution investments, some pretty big numbers there. For September 2025, it's $526 million. That amount represents construction funds that we hold on behalf of our clients. If I adjust those numbers out of the total assets, what you see is total net assets of approximately $25.5 million at September 2025, and that's approximately $1.7 million higher than where we were last year. So that year-over-year growth, as it typically is driven by our net income over the period that finds its way into assets such as investments or loans through the CILP program. But one thing I do want to call to your attention specifically, apart from normal activity, is down in the restricted asset section, you will see a line item, school readiness and child daycare. And as was explained in the September board meeting by Krista Johnson, that $4.4 million in restricted funds that were part of a loan guarantee program for childcare that we were participating in with OEC, those funds have been lifted from restriction. And we'll flip up to the top section, total unrestricted investments, which you can see rose to $15 million as a result of that change after having been, you know, a much lower number in September 2024. So a redistribution there from restricted assets to unrestricted, and those funds are now invested and available for use, for example, in further lending through the CILP program. Any questions on balance sheet asset movements?
Charles, this is Peter.
Yes.
Excuse me. It looks like there's a big change in, this is under related parties, under assets, a large change from last September to this September in due from Chesla. You know, it's almost double.
Mm-hmm.
What's behind that?
Yeah, I think it's largely timing, Peter. You know, that results from services that chief of staff provide to Chesla as an organization, whether it be finance or legal.
Yeah.
And it's just timing. Those funds will, those numbers will come down as Chesla pays, returns the money to chief.
All right. Thank you. Okay.
And then our last stop on the review of the financials, if we could go to page 29, Kara, this is the dashboard that we provide you with. Apart from looking straight at the financials, as we just did, the income statement and the balance sheet, this page is particularly useful in looking at trending over time. So let me direct you to the upper left, where we look at year-to-date revenues. I think this is a pretty important graph to look at. You can see after fiscal year 23, Starting with fiscal year 24, we've launched into an upward trajectory. You can see the blue bar. If you note the scale, it begins at 1,750,000. So the blue bar is particularly large. That is our admin fees. And you can see that that has risen for the last 3 years. I also wanted to call out that when you look at our most recent year, and this is showing you the first quarter of each year, when you look at our most recent year, you now see a red bar on top that had not been there before. That is the interest earned on the CLP loans, which have increased in size over time. So we're happy to see a little bit of diversification in the revenue stream. If you look down below on the bottom left, you'll see revenues and expenses side by side with the actuals in red and the budget numbers in blue. I'm going to look at the revenue column on the left and note that each one of those periods, whether it's budget or actuals, is increasing as we proceed through the quarters, the last 4 quarters. And also, each of those numbers is in excess of $2 million. So, similar to the graph above, revenues increasing over time. You can see the trend below for more recent quarters. Looking at the yellow bars in the center on the bottom, this is the capital investment loan program that I've been discussing and how those balances have grown over the last 4 quarters. We do have an expected closing next week and another loan in the pipeline. So we hope to see by the next time we look at this again, further increase in the size of those numbers. And then finally, I'll touch on the chart in the top center, where you see the pie chart showing the split out of our outstanding bonds. The total outstanding bonds at the end of the quarter are approximately $9.3 million, which is about $4 billion, which is about $400 million higher than it was this time a year ago. Once again, shaping the increases in revenue that we see and the increases in the dollars that you saw on the balance sheet. Finally, looking at the top section where you see the trend of bond issuance as it has been over the years, starting in fiscal year 23 with $289 million. Those numbers are pretty small if you're looking at the screen. They've increased every year, and also the amount of new fundings has been in excess of 80% for each of those new issues. This year so far, we're at $161 million in new issues. But as you can see, only 17.8% or $28 million of that relates to new issues. The budgeted number is 93.7 for the full year. So we've already surpassed that number. But the 93.7 was fully new issues. So in terms of new issues, we still have a way to go. You may remember that when we set the budget, we were very conservative this year in setting that 93.7 new issues number as a result of concerns over the status of tax-exempt bonds. With that being said, I think we see some very good trends here and expect to be able to show more to you and more of the same next quarter. Any questions here on the dashboard?
Any questions for Charles? Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
All right. Thank you, Charles. All right. excuse me. Next two agenda items are preliminary staff memos from Dan, or presented by Dan. Dan, I'll turn it over to you for Hartford Healthcare. Dan, your microphone's turned off.
I haven't done this in a while.
There you go.
So sorry about that. So
That's all
Hartford
right.
Healthcare intends to issue the Series 2026A bonds to finance significant capital improvements across their campuses, the acquisition of ECHN, and refund existing debt. The original expected par amount was to be $750 million. That may increase to over $800 million with the addition of additional capital reimbursements. Highlights from the project list include a new patient tower at Hartford Hospital, the $86 million acquisition of ECHN, and additional $60 million in necessary improvements at those two campuses, and then the refinancing of the Series E, F, and 2020B bond issuances. Hartford Healthcare has engaged Morgan Stanley to underwrite the bonds. The structure is still being contemplated, but it is expected to be multimodal with a fixed and variable rate series, as well as possible inclusion of put bonds. The debt may be also be enhanced with a letter of credit and bond insurance. HHC and Morgan Stanley hope to post the POS at the beginning of the new year. As a result, they will be seeking final approval at the special board meeting in December. Kind of a highlights from the credit analysis. Utilization has been positive and projects to be level in 2025. Operations and margins have improved consistently since fiscal year 2022 is comparable to the benchmark. Liquidity has also improved. The reimbursements of capital expenditures should improve these metrics as well. And though Hartford Healthcare is still below the benchmark of A-rated healthcare institutions. The leverage demonstrates kind of Hartford Healthcare's use of debt. Its debt service coverage ratio is the one area kind of where it falls below those benchmark of A-rated institutions. So with that, are there any questions?
Any questions for Dan?
I've never heard the term. Excuse me.
Sorry, Peter. Dan, go ahead.
Go ahead.
I have not heard the term put bonds. So I'm not familiar with that.
Yeah, so put bonds are short-term bonds. They do have a standard 30-year amortization, but they're priced to sell, priced to be called in a short period of time, typically 5 to 7 years.
Thank you.
Dan, I'm always curious if there's a financial advisor on these transactions. Does HHC have?
Yeah, HHC has been engaged, and they've been working with Kaufman Hall for years. Kaufman Hall has been able to help them throughout a lot of the past couple financing, and is working with them on this transaction as also the energy as a service.
Good. That's a great healthcare financial advisor.
Yeah.
Also, the refundings, Series E and F are fixed rate, so those are going to be currently callable at some point. But the Series 2020, those are those put bonds, I guess, that are being refunded. Is that correct?
Yeah, so it's still contemplated on the structures of the refundings and what that looks. There may be actually a forward delivery put, or but so it's still trying to, Morgan Stanley is trying to figure out the final structure of how to address those.
Okay, just curious. Thank you.
Dan, just a quick question on the new patient tower. Is that going to be at the current site? I just look at that area down there. It seems pretty congested already. Is that where it's going to be located?
Yeah, it's supposed to be right in that neighborhood. Yes, it is. And it's not the only thing that's going to be down there. There is, and we can share, I think there was an article that was shared to us kind of like just the Hartford projects. There's a lot of investments being made at the Hartford campus, and it will be pretty tight with all the construction going on, but I think they're making a sizable investment onto that campus.
Yeah. Okay. I mean, if that's the plan, I'm sure there's room. It just, from a layperson's perspective, it's pretty, pretty congested as it is, but yeah.
Yeah.
Okay.
Parking is horrible.
Yeah. Other than that, it's a welcome scenario. Okay, any other questions on Hartford Healthcare? All right, Dan, Trinity?
Yeah, actually, this one I'm going to be turning over to Julian to present.
All right, Julian, the floor is yours.
Yes, can everyone hear me okay?
Yes.
Okay, great. So this is the presentation of Trinity's T. By alphabetical count, this would be their 20th issuance. The proposed $42 million issuance will be a public offering led and underwritten by Barclays. Proceeds are intended to be utilized to fund on-campus renovations as well as refunding two outstanding issues, Series L from 2008 and Series Q from 2017. The borrower here is Trinity. As everyone is well aware, Trinity is a private nonprofit institution of higher education located here in Hartford, Connecticut. Trinity is a longstanding client of CHIFA's with three outstanding issues totaling just over $100 million. An acknowledgement of some recent changes in leadership at the school with the president and CFO. Staff set up a meeting with their new CFO, Scott Jordan. By way of background, Scott was most recently the Dean of Finance and Administration at Harvard, with prior roles at UConn and the Commonwealth of Massachusetts. Overall, we had what Dan and I felt was a great meeting. We kind of left that meeting with a strong indication of Trinity's intent and focus on improving their offering to better compete with their peers. From a credit rating perspective, Trinity is currently undergoing a refresh, but as of February 2025, their A2 rating was affirmed with a stable outlook. The Series T proceeds, as aforementioned, will be used on on-campus projects. $10 million of the $42 million proposed would be considered the new money portion. Series L and Q will be refunded. Series L is currently variable rate, and Trinity's intent with this refunding would be to fix that debt. And Series Q actually has an imminent maturity in April of 2026. So they are in kind of crucial need to restructure that debt. From a structural perspective, it's currently contemplated that the Series T would be broken into two different pieces. So the T1 would be tax exempt, and that would include the new money, $10 million, in addition to the refunding of Series L. And then T2 would be a taxable portion, which would be the refunding of Series Q, which, as currently contemplated, the previous improvements used are out of remaining useful life, and that's why that portion of the issuance would need to be considered taxable. Both of the tranches would be considered fixed rate and unenhanced. Further, I can run through some credit highlights. Admissions and enrollment have been strong and steady at Trinity. Admission applications have increased 25% over the past five fiscal years, with the school increasing its selectivity. Trinity's endowment has seen continued growth, increasing by 7% since fiscal year 2021. Also notably, the makeup of their donor contributions has largely shifted from annual gifts to capital fund contributions, which bodes well for the school's ability to support its ongoing needs. Student charges have continued to rise. However, these have been in lockstep with increased tuition discounting. This is a trend that we're seeing across all of their peer set, where Trinity and some of their peers are seeing a consistent challenge with trying to limit tuition discounting to reduce the reliance on their endowment for operations. Total revenues have increased since fiscal year 2021, largely driven by the aforementioned endowment draws in addition to auxiliary income. Finally, monthly days cash on hand and debt service ratios fall slightly below Moody's A medians. However, Trinity, as a longstanding issuer of bonds and borrower, have consistently demonstrated a track record of managing cash and servicing their debt obligations appropriately. I'll leave it there and open the floor up for any questions.
Thank you, Julian. Any questions? And the final memo will come next month as well. Is that correct?
Yes, that's correct.
Okay. Peter, Peter.
No, go ahead. I had a question.
I had a quick question. Sure. Thanks, Julian. Appreciate the overview. Can you provide a little bit of maybe just color on the operating performance and kind of what they've seen there over the last couple of years.
Just 1 second.
Yes. I mean, largely the operating performance has been pretty stable. If you dig into their audits, you will notice that a university that has an endowment as such is kind of using that as their backbone to support their enrollment and kind of the affordability of their offering. If I could reference a specific chart within the presentation, there's a revenue chart, and as you can see, they have steadily increased their student charges over fiscal year 21 through 25, but then down a little bit from there. If you look at the net tuition per student, you can see that number has grown at a much lower rate. So, Trinity CFO was pretty candid about the fact that this is a line item that they're very focused on, but in reality, between them and their peers, they're all kind of needing to use their financial resources, that being the endowment, to make sure that their offering is competitive with their peer set.
Thank you. And then just a quick follow-up. Are there sort of modifications being made to budget or program in pursuit of expense reduction, or are they comfortable with kind of where they're at?
That's certainly something that we'd like to dig into a little bit more between this presentation and the final.
That's fine. Yep.
I would also just note that the entire kind of chief financial officer and that whole team are new. So between him and the president, I think they all are also kind of digesting what they had before them.
Okay, very good. Thank you, Julian.
Peter.
Sess, did you have a question?
I guess to follow up on Mike, I mean, I was looking at those charts too under the revenue. The discount has really been going up for the past 3 years.
Right.
So, which is obviously, I know that all of us in higher ed are facing that, but nonetheless, it's concerning. So I don't know if they had some, even though they're trying to be more selective, but perhaps they're doing that by increasing the discount. I'm not sure. It doesn't seem like the headcount is any better. It's actually gone down, I believe, when we go back up.
The headcount's been pretty stable over the
It's
past
less
5 years.
than last year, because last year the headcount was 2190, and this fiscal it's 2165, the FTE headcount.
Yeah, I think the one thing that we can also add to our final presentation that I think would be helpful is something that Julian and I talked about, because I think the students that are looking at these schools are kind of looking at the whole athletic conference, the NESCRO, the New England. And so those schools are really just competing against those students. And so Trinity's competing against those and kind of not only providing the benchmark on a national wide level, but try to compare it as to the benchmark to its competitors. I think within that small thing might give kind of insight, because a lot of those schools rely on that endowment as to kind of meet the operating margin for them. They're all really relying on those draws to keep them kind of afloat on that sense. So we could probably provide that additional information within the next final presentation as well.
You
I
know,
did
Dan,
want to.
I think you're correct. The NESCAC schools, they're fortunate to have the endowments that they do, but to use the endowment as continually bailing out, I think is a bit of a worrisome trend going forward. I mean, I would hope that they'd be maintaining the discipline. Don't they say a 4 to 6% spending rate is where you should be? And if you need to draw more than that, I would think it'd be a little concerning, very honestly.
This is Krista. Can you guys hear me?
Yes.
Okay. Sorry, I didn't want to interrupt. I just wanted to let you know, in regards to their tuition discounting, at 47%, It is the second highest in our chief of portfolio, but their reliance on tuition and auxiliaries is only at 60%, which is quite low compared to the rest of the schools in the higher ed space.
Okay.
I was going to ask Peter, do we know what their typical drawdown has been on the endowment?
I don't know. Julianne or Dan might know what the draw is.
And I don't have that off of hand, but that's certainly a data point that we can be sure to address.
Yeah.
Peter, I have a question.
Go ahead, Kim.
Could somebody please follow up about this section of assets where it says governmental grant receivables? I think that's the
Where are you,
right line.
Kim? What page is
Balance,
that?
I'm on page 57.
Okay.
And so on governmental grant receivables, it pops out at 462,000 there. I know the number's entered wrong, but I would just double check on that. It's a large number compared to the prior years. And right now, knowing administration with the government is, you know, is that if that's governmental, state or federal, then federal I would be concerned on because there's a lot of changes going on in that arena. So I would just use that as a follow-up. In addition, when we look at the when we look at the reporting and the statistical numbers that they gave us for student data, I know that they're reporting out on a fiscal year basis, but maybe they could also report on the fall of 26 right now because fall has already started. And what do their numbers look like right now compared to the prior year?
Yeah.
So Kim, this is Dan. Just to add to that, so yeah, there was a rounding cell formatting error. So it should be 462 for the grants receivable. So we did ask, obviously, what was the college exposure to the federal grants? Obviously, that is a concern. Trinity actually receives very little federal grants. This grant money is all related to financial aid, Pell grants in that sense. So it's not like research grants or anything like that. So they have very little exposure to changes in regard to the federal government regarding those kind of grants that are being recaptured. And regarding to the enrollments are is actually as of October, so of that fiscal year. So we are expected to have the October or this new school year's enrollment with our final presentation.
That's what I was
Okay.
looking for. Thank you.
Yeah.
Great. Thanks, Dan. Thanks, Julian. Any other questions? Okay. Thank you both. All right. Dan, still with you with Fairfield Country Day, the final
Yep.
memo.
Yeah, we're gonna bounce back and forth, Julie and I. So,
All right.
Fairfield Country Day School is seeking the approval of the Series A bonds in an amount not to exceed $12,500,000. The bonds will be issued as a limited public offering to Silvercrest. Before we address kind of the board questions that we received at the last meeting, I would like to kind of have Julian provide an overview of our visit with the school. And in response to a lot of those questions, we felt as an opportunity to go to the school, kind of see what the campus is and meet with their administration to kind of really get a good insight on kind of what they're trying to do and their current plan. So, Julian.
Yeah, thank you, Dan. So on October 30th of 2025, staff visited Fairfield Country Day School and met with leadership, including the head of school. The campus presented well overall, though, kind of as we walked through the campus with the team, there were certainly some kind of observable capital needs. Leadership was pretty forthcoming with the fact that this financing would be pretty transformative for the school, allowing them to enhance their overall offering and attract additional student interest. Leadership has been undergoing other additional efforts in addition to actually hiring a director of enrollment and a director of business development to try to kind of improve their capital development plans. Historically, the school has not operated with any debt, and they've capitalized any and all projects by way of capital campaigns. The previous capital campaign that they had was about 13 years ago for their 75th anniversary. They successfully raised $7.5 million, which they put into capital programs at the site. In conjunction with this financing, they communicated that they were going to kick off a new campaign with a target of $12 million to supplement the bond financing. But overall, Dan and I kind of walked away from that visit with a better sense of kind of what the product is today and where they'd like to go. I think ultimately, Fairfield Country Day School does have headwinds with the fact that their competition long-term will be public schools in the area, in addition to some larger independent schools that candidly just have larger endowments by way of their admission kind of total school size. This is a smaller school with total enrollment today and historically around 200 students.
Thanks, Julian. So some of the questions we received, obviously, it was who is Fairfield Country Day School competing with? As Julian said, the school acknowledges that their biggest competitors are most likely the public schools and other independent and parochial schools. The challenges with that is obviously students can go to school for free at the public schools, or the tuition at the parochial schools are significantly less than the independent school and the tuition offered by Fairfield Country Day School. There's a couple other competitors that they acknowledged within the area. Some of these are mixed schools with boys and girls, and others are boys only. The type of student or families that they're targeting are really is goes along really kind of the image that they're trying to portray. They're not trying to portray it to being an athletic school. Their focus is really on that boys' education. They have investments in a boys lab, which focuses on the education needed for boys, especially in the elementary and middle school age. And so that's kind of really the target families that they're focusing on. I would say kind of really the strategies of what they're doing is they're starting to implement kind of a modernization of their whole enrollment, admissions, and development office. For years, they really haven't had a dedicated staff or dedicated departments really to undertake those activities. Only recently, they've really kind of formalized and committed to those activities with new marketing plans, new staff, to really kind of drive those efforts to expand their marketing, their outreach to new families, as well as aggressively increase enrollment. As it relates to kind of their future plans, their enrollment goals are reaching up to 230 students. They're currently at 200 students now, and they're hoping their efforts as it relates to the marketing plan and admissions would really boost that those additional students up to 230, which would improve their revenues and really improve their operating margin for the school. So as an overview of the transaction, like I said, the bonds will be issued as a limited public offering to Silvercrest. The security for the bond issuance is a pledge of gross revenue, a mortgage, and a debt service reserve fund. The funds will be used to finance capital improvements across the campus, notably modernizing their skating rink and an adjacent athletic center, as well as other capital needs throughout their facilities. The school will need to satisfy debt service coverage ratio 1x by June 30th, 2027, and 1.25x by June 30th, 2028. We discussed this with the school, kind of the challenges of that, looking at their current financials. They are well aware of that and what is needed to achieve that. They feel confident that if they are able to reach their enrollment goals of 233, that this will be easy for them to achieve. Other covenants include are the enrollment covenant and a day's cash on hand of 45 days. One of the things that are being contemplated right now with the transaction is the investors requiring that they maintain acquire a DACA for the transaction, and they address a line of credit which is secured by an all assets pledge. Silvercrest does not want that the debt to be issued on parity with that line of credit. These bonds will be offered as a fixed rate with a 30-year maturity and a 10-year call provision. Are there any questions?
Any questions for Dan or Julian? Dan, I guess I'm just kind of curious, just overall, how do you and or Julian feel about the school? I mean, I look at some of their financial data and I don't know, it'd be a little worrisome for me, but I guess, the enrollment is flat or declining. Their endowment, they must have been rating it because the endowment has fallen the past 5 years. What's your general sense as to their general health or their direction? I mean,
I think the challenge here is that after meeting with the school is understanding kind of how are they going to get to the results. We understand the plan and how they think they achieve that. The ability to succeed and get that, it's kind of unclear. I think the school is at a crossroads right now, trying to compete with other schools. It is challenging in that market to do that, especially at those grade levels. They've been able to build really strong relationships with Fairfield Prep and able to build a pipeline to that schools, but really to get those families to commit to their school before moving on to Fairfield Prep is going to be the challenge. I think as a school, they need to understand kind of how to lean into that identity of the all boys education and the benefits of that, and really trying to attract those unique families that want that or desire that. I think if they're able to make these financing with the $20 million of capital projects that would be addressed by this financing and the capital campaign, I think that would allow them to get there. I think they would become more attractive for some of the families that are looking for the athletics, and some families that are looking for the earlier preschool and kindergarten kind of enrollment opportunities with some of the improvements at the playgrounds and those facilities for those for those children in grades. But I think it is a challenging point. I think it is, they're at a point where they need to take on debt. They need to make these investments, because without it, I think they're going to be struggling.
Okay. All right. I appreciate your insights. Thank you.
I would just want to make one other comment, if you don't mind, Peter.
Yep. Go ahead, Kimberly.
Their goal to help achieve some of those financial areas is, to me, a stretch goal based on the numbers that have already been provided. If a goal of tuition for 233 and that mark hasn't been made, it's not like they could even look back. So in the investments that they're looking to make, you said 230, excuse me, that they're looking to make in an ice rink and in a laboratory, is what I heard you say, possibly other renovations. You said it was crystal clear to you by looking at the campus that it sounded like it was tired and it needed other updating. Is this going to give the draw that it's going to need to bring on additional students? That would be my questions, along with the financial struggle that brought to our attention.
Yeah, so going down to your first point, I think like looking at the historical, what does a campus look like with 230 kids on there? I think our look back goes back to 21. They actually admitted they at one point had 280 kids on campus. Looking at the campus, that would have been a very crowded campus. And I think they acknowledged that that was way too many kids at all times. So I think they've had larger enrollment pre-COVID. I think they've resized post-COVID at that 200. And that's obviously evident by the financials. That's not the right size. They need to be a little bit higher. or they need to have a different kind of payer mix, a mix that doesn't rely so much on kind of financial aid. I think looking at some of the capital improvements that they need to do, I think with the expectation of the tuition that you'd be paying, a family would be paying, I think some of that stuff needs to, would make the school attractive. I think paying the amount of money that is for that school is you kind of expect certain much. And I think this will help bring that up there so families can recognize that. I think it goes along like the hockey rink. The hockey rink is a really significant facility for them. They use it for a lot of different events. And right now it's an outdoor rink. It's really attractive to a lot of to the families, but it's challenging. I think making the investments to make that fully enclosed with its own athletic facility related to it, I think would be really attractive for those families. Build off of that.
Thank you for sharing that.
Okay. Thanks, Dan. Anyone else? Okay, this is the final memo presented by staff. Would someone like to make a motion to accept staff's recommendation on Fairfield Country Day School? Anyone?
Sure, I'll make a motion.
Thank you, Steve. Is there a second?
I'll second it. It's Mike.
Thank you. So it's been made and seconded that we accept staff's recommendation on the Fairfield Country Day School issue. We've had some discussion. Is there any more questions for any of Dan or Julian or anyone on the chief of staff? Any questions, comments, or any further discussion? Anything?
Yeah, just one quick question on the capital campaign. It seems like they're kind of matching the capital campaign to the bond raise. Is there, I mean, if the capital campaign falls short, is there a revisiting of any of this stuff?
I think it's kind of unrelated. I think what they have a wish list of $20 million of projects that they need to address. And so as a result of bond financing, that's going to solve a $9 million financing gap after debt to reserve fund and cost of issuance is funded. So that's kind of where they're targeting that $12 million approximately as the capital campaign. So I think obviously I don't think they have the capacity for any more debt. So if the capital campaign comes short, I think it's more of, okay, we got to prioritize these projects.
And if the capital campaign falls short, would the debt covered projects be the ones that are at the top of the priority list?
Yeah. So I think the intent and the allocation of what we're doing for tax analysis is funding kind of the bond will be financing the bigger projects, the hockey rink, the more impactful projects.
Okay.
Okay, anyone else? Any other questions, comments, or discussion? Fairfield Country Day? Okay, the motion's been made and seconded to accept staff's recommendation for the Series A issue. There's no other discussion or questions. All those in favor, please say aye.
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 Anyone opposed? Any abstentions? Thank you. Motion carries unanimously.
Thank you.
All right. The next one, I believe, is a private placement, isn't it, Dan?
Yep. The Early Learning Magnet School issue, Series A. So staff is seeking approval to issue up to $95 million to Learn Project, Inc., a subsidiary of Learn, to finance the acquisition and construction of a new magnet school in Watertown, Connecticut. The bonds will be a direct placement with M&T Bank or a subsidiary of the bank. Learn is a REST, similar to ACES, which we approved in a prior meeting, serving 25 towns in New Haven, Middlesex, and New London counties. It operates 4 magnet schools in its service area and provides additional support to the schools within their district. Learn itself does not have a 501c3 exemption, so the financing would be through a subsidiary called Learn Project, Inc., which does have that 501c3 exemption. The reason why LEARN doesn't have one is it was created by municipalities, so it's considered a governmental entity for tax purposes. The funds will be used to finance the new magnet school serving pre-K through second, enrolling 510 kids. The project has been awarded a Connecticut school construction grant and is expected to be reimbursed up to 95% for eligible costs. This financing will allow LEARN to manage cash flow during the construction period while waiting for reimbursements from the state. Security for the financing include a pledge of gross receipts, mortgage on two properties, and a guarantee by LEARN. LEARN will be required to maintain a debt service coverage ratio of 1.1 times. The bonds will be structured as a drawdown bond with the ability to draw during the first three years. Following that period, the bonds will be fully amortized over the remaining 27 years. LEARN is also required to pay down the bonds as they receive reimbursements received from the state for the project. It is expected that after the drawdown period, the par amount outstanding for the bonds will be less than $18 million after the pay down from the reimbursement from the state. It actually, the borrower and M&T Bank are looking at a number closer to $10 to $12 million actually, as it relates to that. So really kind of give you an overview of kind of what the transaction is and kind of how it is that they're using this transaction to finance the project expenses during the construction period. They anticipate that it may take up to 6 months for the state to approve and pay some of these reimbursements that they submit to the state as it relates to the grant program. And this will just help them manage the cash flow during the construction period. So staff is seeking the approval to issue $95 million for LEARN Project Inc.
And it's a direct placement M&T, you said, right?
Yep.
Okay. So due diligence resides with M&T, correct?
Yes, but we do provide for information only, some credit information.
Yep. Okay. Would someone like to move acceptance of staff's recommendation on the early learning magnet school issue, Series A? Is there a motion?
No move.
Thank you, Seth. Is there a second?
I'll second.
Thank you, Mike. All right, the motion's been made and seconded to accept staff's recommendation on the early learning magnet school issue, Series A. We've had some discussion. Are there any additional questions or comments? Any discussion? Questions for Dan? All right, hearing none, all those in favor, please say aye.
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 Is there anyone opposed? Any abstentions? Thank you. The motion carries.
Thank you.
All right, Dan, one more final memo.
One more.
Livewell?
Yes, Livewell Alliance, Inc. Staff is seeking the approval to issue up to $85 million to Livewell Alliance for purposes of refinancing the Series 2022 bond issuance, which financed the transformation of their campus. The bonds will be used to refinance the prior bonds at 101.5% premium, fund necessary reserve funds, and a payment of a deferred development fee. Livewell is located in Plantsville, Connecticut. The community has 76 skilled nursing beds and 65 assisted living units, and they're dedicated to supporting the needs of people impacted by dementia. The bonds will be issued as a limited public offering to Hamlin Capital Management. The bonds will be secured by a gross revenue pledge, mortgage, and a debt service reserve fund. Livewell will be required to maintain 100 days cash on hand and a debt service coverage ratio of 1.2 times. I just kind of want to clarify kind of in the memo, there has been an update to that covenant of the debt service coverage ratio. Since the mailing, Livewell now will report quarterly on the debt service coverage ratio, but is not required to start testing until September 30th, 2026, where their requirement would be 1.1 times. And as of March 31st, 2028, the debt service coverage ratio requirement will go up to 1.2 times. There's also been an update to the occupancy requirement, which will be an average occupancy rate of 80%.
Dan, those clarifications were sent out in a subsequent email to the board, correct? So we all have that information?
No, they were not in this the subsequent. This was just related. The subsequent information was included as just on the management projections.
Okay, I didn't mean to interrupt. Is that
Yeah, no
you're
Rob.
off?
Yeah, so just the bonds will be fixed, will be issued as fixed rate, and the interest rate will be set between a floor of 6% and 6.2%. If the board approves this transaction, staff is also asking for the approval to waive our approved underwriting guidelines for this transaction. Hamlin is requesting that the bonds are issued in a minimum denominations of $25,000 to their clients. If they're held by non-Hamlin clients, a minimum denomination of $500,000. Our current guidelines state that unrated limited public offerings are to be issued in minimum denominations of $100,000 to qualified institutional buyers or accredited investors. Staff is comfortable with this modification, the underwriting guidelines for this transaction, since it was already previously approved for the prior construction issuance in 22.
We lowered the threshold to 25,000 for the in 2022 for the construction loan.
Yes.
And the premise is that the clients, Hamlin's clients, are sophisticated
Yeah.
investors, but they were only placing it with their clients, but they wanted it to be in smaller pieces so that they could, on a practical level, spread it amongst the portfolio. So that was the rationale the last time it was approved,
Yeah.
and they're applying that same rationale now.
It just gave you a background of who Hamlin is. Hamlin is a New York-based investment and advisory firm that manages approximately $6 billion of assets for institutions and high net worth individuals. All of their clients are either accredited investors or qualified institutional buyer. And they currently have a minimum account or a $2 million account minimum for their clients. And really, so this gives them the flexibility to diversify the investments throughout their clients' individual portfolios.
I guess it, if it's staff's recommendation, I guess I would support it, but I also have to say, we have these guidelines in place for a reason, and in the past we've been comfortable with 100,000, and I don't know if you feel, if staff feels comfortable making the exception, I guess so be it. But I guess philosophically, we have guidelines in place for a reason, and we came up with that for that policy for a reason. But
Yeah, and
no, I think no.
I was just going to say, I think part of the rationale for the policy was $100,000 denoms, as things are sort of traded, will put it more in the realm of, only high net worth accredited investors, a suitable thing for that group. So the requirement that if this leaves a Hamlin portfolio, it has to be and $500,000 denoms, that was the rationale for, okay, there's still that protection to the average investor that they're not going to mistakenly end up investing in this because, like some small investor who's looking for, just a retirement fund or something.
Okay, that's fair.
Yeah, and I would add, I think the policy is correct. The policy that we have in place is correct. I think we are for the Fairfield Country Day School transaction, that is a limited public offering, and those bonds will be issued in denominations of $100,000. I think that's
Right.
appropriate. It's for this transaction as a follow-up to the original issuance. I think it's appropriate that we continue to make that exception so that Livewell continue moving forward with their transformation and reaching stabilization for that campus and allowing to be in a better financial situation as they move forward to more long-term financing for their project.
Okay. All right. That's fair. Thank you, Jeanette. Thank you, Dan. And I apologize. I've already forgotten. Has the motion been made to accept the recommendation on LiveWell, or do we need a motion?
I think we need one.
I think we
need.
Yeah. I'm happy to make that motion.
All right. Thank you, Mike. Is there a second?
Sure. I'll second it.
Thank you, Steve. And I apologize for my memory lapse. So the motion's been made and seconded to accept staff's recommendation on the LiveWell Alliance Series 2025 offering. We've had some discussion and some questions. Any further comments? Any questions for staff? Discussion? Thoughts?
I have one further comment.
Go ahead, Kimberly.
As we look at projections and we look at their financials, I mean, actuals are actuals of the way they're actually performing from a income statement, profit and loss operation. And when you're receiving projections, which to me is like their budget and where they're projecting out, where is the discipline to get them to actually balance a budget in the projections? And, you know, I think that as I look at municipalities, if somebody was to give me a budget that looks like this, I have to say that we ask them to come up with a contingency plan and do the hard work to balance the budget, unless their reliance in this case is going to be net assets, which would be eroding their overall, you know, worth. I just wanted to ask that and put that on the table for everybody, because it's one of my concerns.
Sure.
No, I think it's a valid point. I think it's a conversation we have with a lot of these senior living organizations that are going through these transformative investments, especially when you look at kind of when they drastically change their business models. So LiveWell does not have a huge campus. I was able to go out there earlier this year. It's absolutely a beautiful place, but it's a small campus. So the construction was a disruption for them and their residents. So it's not like they were able to build kind of these new campus aside and continue operations. So during those construction periods, they really had to pare down kind of the number of residents they were able to serve, the occupancy, and that has really impacted kind of their revenues and their cash flows as they go that. I think it is a challenging, I think they anticipate reaching kind of full stabilization, right? What they're arguing is kind of that full operations, full occupancy, not until really 2028. And so that's kind of where you start seeing that nearing kind of a break-even point from there. I also think it's more challenging for an organization like LiveWell than other senior living campuses, just because of the type of patients. They're not dealing with, they don't operate independent living. All of their, they only provide skilled nursing or assisted living because they're targeting patients that have more needs than some of our other clients. So their expenses are higher. So I think that is a challenging thing. I think the hope is that they reach more of that break-even point and become more profitable as they move out of this financing into that new long-term financing. This financing is intended to really kind of just kind of bridge them to stabilization and get them to a point where they're more financial viable spot to really get more affordable long-term financing for the organization.
Thank you.
Thanks for the question, Kimberly. Thank you, Dan. Anything else? Further questions or comments? Okay, motion's been made and seconded to accept staff's recommendation on LiveWell Alliance, the Series 2025 issue. All those in favor, please say aye.
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 Is there anyone opposed? Any abstentions? Thank you. Motion carries. Thank you all.
Thank you,
Dan. Thank you, Julian. Okay. Moving on, the proposed legislative agenda. I'm not sure that Dan Junge is available, so I believe Jeanette is going to walk us through that.
Yes, I will. So Dan Junge is over at the Capitol. There, as I mentioned previously, there's a special session going on today and tomorrow. And one of the reasons he's over there is because we were hoping actually that one of the Cheslow legislative proposals could be part of the special session. At this point, it looks like that's probably not going to happen, and it would be something we would put on the agenda for the regular session. And so that's what's described at the top of the legislative agenda. It's the second bullet point. And so the basic concept is the federal government in the One Big Beautiful Bill Act terminated the Grad PLUS loan program. There are about $98 million of Grad PLUS loans made in Connecticut. And so this is a program that both graduate students and schools had come to rely on heavily. And Cheslow, similar to actually other Cheslow-like authorities across the country, we're trying to develop a product that can meet some of that need, not all of that need. There is a transition period and a grandfathering that's going to go into it. So there would be some issuance of regular Cheslow bonds, but the legislative agenda aspect is we were looking for some dollars from the state to support middle tier credit and very weak credit borrowers. So the existing federal program really didn't have any underwriting criteria, and it covered the credit spectrum of who could get a loan, which is actually not that uncommon with some of the federal programs. And so for Cheslow to do anything back with a bond issuance, we can only do something that meets our criteria. And this proposal is seeking dollars from the state to support some of those lower credit borrowers so that they can still pursue graduate studies. So that's the focus of the second bullet of the Cheslow proposals. And as I mentioned at this point, the expectation is that would probably land in the regular session. We've gotten a lot of positive feedback from the co-chairs of the higher ed committee, as well as other leadership in the General Assembly. So we're actually hopeful that we'll get that those additional dollars. And then just the first Cheslow proposal is something that's come up in prior legislative agendas, which is increasing our scarfback bond limit to $750 million. This is an amount, it's currently $300 million. One of the reasons for that is as we, over time, as we start adding dollars that we're issuing for these graduate loans, you know, it could add up to substantial amounts, and just to have the flexibility. And this, we have run this by the treasurer's office in terms of their comfort level with our increasing the limit, and Sarah Sanders expressed a lot of comfort with increasing the level, which has been held at $300 million for several years, and actually is lower than what some other quasis are, most notably the Housing Finance Authority, which I believe is close to $1 billion. And then we continue to try to increase the volume cap for Cheslow bonds are under private activity volume cap. And again, it goes back to being able to accommodate some of this additional borrowing if we end up doing graduate loans. We only typically issue 30 to the extent we can't get more volume cap. We would have to issue on a taxable basis and then pass some of that on to borrowers in the form of a higher loan rate. So that's the concept behind the two Cheslow proposals. On the CHIFA side, it's more of, they are not specific proposals. They're more things that we want to keep an eye on as opportunities might present themselves. And that's to sort of be able to use CHIFA CDC, for example, as well as CHIFA to continue to increase access to childcare programs. That the state, as the state seeks to enhance, you know, affordable childcare opportunities and also community development opportunities. So as programs evolve, whether they're a DECD or the Office of Early Childhood, the concept is we would keep ourselves in the loop, both legislatively and with the heads of those agencies, the leadership of those agencies, so that we're, if it makes sense for chief of CDC to play a role, we will be prepared to do that. So it may or may not actually require any type of legislation. So that is the legislative agenda. Are there any questions or comments?
Any questions for Jeanette? Okay. Thank you, Jeanette.
Yeah.
Peter, this is Danette. Denise, it's an action item to approve the agenda.
Oh, I'm sorry. Thank you, Denise. Denise has just reminded us that adopting the proposed legislative agenda is an action item. So would someone like to make a motion to accept the staff's recommendation for the legislative agenda as just described by Jeanette? Is there a motion?
So moved, Mike.
All right, Mike Angelini moved it. I'll be happy to second it. We've just heard the presentation on the proposed legislative agenda. Are there any questions or comments? Any discussion? All right, hearing none, all those in favor of adopting the proposed legislative agenda as presented, please say aye.
Aye.
Is there anyone opposed? Any abstentions? Thank you. Motion carries unanimously. The next agenda item, a little bit of a housekeeping, but it is the 2026 board and committee meeting schedule. I think it's in everyone's packet. It is an action item, needs to be adopted. I'm not sure there's any discussion. Well, I should make that assumption. If there is discussion, any questions or comments on the committee schedule for next year, meeting schedule? All right, we do need a board vote to adopt it. Would someone like to make a motion to accept the proposed calendar 2026 meeting schedule? Is there a motion?
So moved.
I'll move it. Is there a second?
Second.
Kimberly seconded. Okay, it's been moved and seconded to adopt the meeting and commit the board and committee meeting schedule as presented. Any discussion, questions, or comments? Hearing none, all those in favor, please say aye.
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 Anyone opposed? Any abstentions? Thank you. Meeting schedule for 2026 has been adopted. Please mark your calendars. Okay, next agenda item is a discussion of the executive director search. I'd like to suggest that we move into executive session for this. Would someone like to make a motion?
So moved, Kim.
Thank you, Kimberly. Is there a second?
I'll second, Mike.
Thank you, Mike. All those in favor of moving into executive session for the purpose of the discussion of executive director's position, please say aye.
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 Anyone opposed? Any abstentions? For the executive session, I would like to invite just the chief of board members to attend. Back, public session. Denise, we just need to adopt the resolution as presented in the media material, correct?
You need to insert the names of the committee members right into the resolution. And if you could just state for the record that no votes were taken in executive session.
Okay. No votes were taken in executive session.
Thank you.
All right. So the there's a resolution in the board package naming the executive director search committee, the members of which are being recommended to be Kim Moore, Steve Elbaum, Peter Lisi, Mike Angelini, with Mike Angelini serving as chair and also engaging Corn Ferry to assist the search committee with the identification and appointment of a new executive director. That is the resolution, and I would like to move adoption of that resolution. Is there a second?
Kim Keniston.
Thank you, Kim. Kimberly, is there any discussion, questions, or comments? All those in favor of adopting the resolution as presented and just described by myself, please say aye.
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 Anyone opposed? Any abstentions? Thank you very much. Mike, you have a committee. Good luck.
Thanks very much. And thank you for everyone's participation, those on the committee and those on the board who will certainly be helping us along the way. Much appreciated.
And let's see, normally at the November meeting, I say to everyone, have a good holiday and I'll see you in January. But we do have a special meeting scheduled for December. So thank you all for your attendance today. And I'll see you. Well, actually, we've got a CDC meeting. So is there a motion for adjournment of the CHIFA meeting? Is there a motion to adjourn? Thank you. Is there a second?
Second, Kim.
All right. Thank you, Kimberly. All those in favor of adjournment, please say aye.
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 Anyone opposed? Any abstentions? All right. We are adjourned.